This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and I'm so excited to see Lisa Coe. It's been a minute since we got to hang out, and of course we're doing it virtually because, hello, this is the world we live in now. But Memory Piece is her new novel. She was a finalist for the National Book Award with The Leavers, which was also a Discover pick, and a finalist for the Discover Great New Writers Award, which doesn't really exist in its old incarnation anymore, but it was really fun to do a lot of yelling about The Leavers when it first came out. And obviously, we weren't alone about that. But Memory Piece, tightly written, starts in the 80s, hits the 90s, takes us into 2040. It's the friendship of three women, Giselle and Jackie and Ellen. And I love the structure of the book. I love these women. We're obviously not going to have spoilers in this conversation because that would be no fun, but plenty we can talk about. But Lisa, it's so good to see you. How are you? How are things?
Yeah, it's been so many years. So glad to be able to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
So when did you start writing Memory Piece? Because, I mean, The Leavers came out and it was kind of nonstop promotion for a couple, 3 years. I mean, you were just doing the thing.
Yeah, it was, it all seems very long ago, but I started writing Memory Piece in the fall of 2016. So it was actually in the gap between when I sold The Leavers and when The Leavers came out, spring 2017. So I think at the time, since The Leavers had taken like 7 years, I was like, well, I'm gonna whip this out in like 2 years. Like, I know how to write a novel now. This is going to be easy. You know, famous last words. So We are in 2024 and like it's finally coming up.
All right. So we're in New Jersey. It's
83, I think.
Okay, yeah. 83. And 4th of July, which I appreciate the setting. And we meet these kids just as they're meeting Ellen and Giselle and Jackie, just as they're meeting each other. And I'm wondering why we're in New Jersey first. I mean, obviously, New York is where the bulk of everything happens, but we're across the Hudson.
We are. Personally, I grew up in New Jersey, also during the 80s. Characters are maybe about like 5 years older than me. I felt, you know, it's sort of, their arc sort of mimics mine. And I really wanted to write about these sort of lifelong friends that are sort of accidentally meeting just because we're part of this larger Chinese diaspora, and sort of coming in and out of their lives, like throughout their whole lives, like those kind of friends that you aren't super close to, but you really are. And like, they influence your life in ways that you don't even realize until much later. So, you know, the book in a way both looks back, as you mentioned, and also looks forward. And I wanted the structure to sort of mimic that experience of, you know, just like waking up now and waking up, you know, in 20 years, just being like, what happened? You know, how did we get here? How do we, you know, it's sort of going from this very conventional, like mundane suburban childhood, which to me is very much represented by New Jersey in the 80s, that sort of, you know, Reagan era American exceptionalism that I grew up being fed by TV and other propaganda, and then, you know, slowly kind of simmering through the 90s and into the future.
I had possibly too much recognition for a lot of things, but I want to start with Giselle. Because I love the way you structure it. Sort of Giselle is front and center in the first section, then Jackie, then Ellen. I understand exactly why you did that, but I'm dancing around it a tiny bit just to avoid some spoilers. But Giselle ends up doing essentially what some people would call performance art. And I'm just going to use that because it's a quick reference point. But I love her art. I think it's wild. I mean, she moves into a mall for a year and only comes out at night. And I'm going to leave out some of the details and whatnot, but it's that kind of, I'm going to write a statement and for X amount of time, usually a year, but there's a different piece where it's a little shorter for different reasons. I love her path and I love her family and I love everything about this because also performance art, like what? Like what? Can we talk about where Giselle came from? Because I feel like there's a lot of your sort of personal feelings about art and being a creative in her work, but yeah, I don't ever see you moving into a mall for a year.
Oh, you know, if the novel writing thing doesn't work out, I hear people.
You know.
It's very lucrative these days. So. Yeah, you know, to answer that question, like, I feel like that's really true. And part of, you know, the seed of even writing the novel in the first place was just kind of just like thinking about what it means to make art under capitalism, which, you know, I'm still thinking about clearly and probably will continue to. And I, you know, just sort of, I don't know, was thinking first about like these memories of my own childhood when pre-career concerns like could just be as weird as I could with my best friends and make up, you know, strange performances, and it was fun and we had joy, and, you know, so different from kind of thinking about like art as a career and all the things involved with that. But I've also always been very fascinated by performance artists, especially the work of the Taiwanese American performance artist Taixing Shea, who Giselle's performances are sort of like a nod to. He's best known for these kind of year-long endurance pieces in the late 70s and early 80s. One where he lives in a mall. He doesn't live in a mall. He lives in a cage by choice for a year. And another one, he's outside, only outside for a year. And there's one where he punches a time clock every hour for a year, meaning he never sleeps more than an hour at a time. So I don't know, these really like extra weird works always kind of spoke to me, because I feel like I very much had this child of immigrants anxiety about like wasting time and like using my time well and using my life well. And, you know, what am I doing? And is it too late? And, you know, there are definitely anxieties that sometimes still keep me up at night. And here was this artist, Taixing Shea, who was literally making art out of wasting time. And he was also an immigrant, Asian immigrant, you know, and the work was about like, you know, just kind of like life is wasting time. And the art itself is about the passage of time. So it sort of solves that tension of like, how do you like live your life and make the money you need to make the art in order to like live your life, you know? And that I think Giselle is sort of grappling with, and her solution is sort of this satirical, like, well, I got to pay rent, so maybe I'll just squat in a mall and that'll solve the problem of like needing a job for a while.
I really loved watching her evolve. There's also a bad boyfriend that I'm going to skirt around a little bit too. But like, of course, Giselle ends up with a bad boyfriend. But also like, yeah, finding a place to live in New York and all of those things where it's like, it just reminded me quite a lot of sort of my adventures when I was in my 20s. And I had just come back to New York and my friends and I were sort of figuring out how to be adults in the world. And oh man, we had no idea. But like, you've got all these moments sort of in Giselle's timeline where it's like, and then they were at Brownies and then they were doing this and da, 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 da. It was fun to revisit that. But I really, the idea that Giselle was always an artist first, right? Like it was less about her being Chinese American. It was less about her being the daughter of immigrants. I mean, yeah, there is a little bit of that tension. And I appreciate it. But it really was always about the art. And that's the piece where I was like, yeah, we don't always get that room to roam, right? Like in a story like this. And it's a little bit like Daniel's music, right? In The Leavers, where it's like Daniel needed a thing. Mm-hmm. And Giselle did some wild stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, you were totally the weirdo that everyone was fascinated by because they didn't know what to do with you. And then we sort of jump forward a tiny bit. We're in the 90s and New York is changing madly. I mean, we're in a moment, obviously, of significant gentrification here now. But the 90s is sort of when things started to break. Like, we still had, like, people living in squats. And I remember when tanks rolled down 13th Street because someone decided the squatters had to go. And I was just at the office that day. Like, New York in the 90s was still kind of the Wild West. And there was still this amazing sense of serendipity and discovery that kind of we don't have anymore. And I loved the way you captured that energy on the page, even though Jackie's basically locked in her room coding. So I'm going to ask you how you pulled off that magic trick. Because really, like, Jackie spends a lot of time, like, Giselle is riding her bike and she's making art and she's doing, and Jackie's kind of coding all the time. But you get this moment, right? Like, the whole thing was laid out and I was like, oh yeah. And those weird parties, there were so many weird parties. It was so weird. It was so weird.
It was such a weird time.
All of it was bizarre. And it just like the amount of money that was rolling through and then suddenly was gone. But yeah. So Jackie and the coding. You knew you had to do that, though, right? I mean, if you're going to capture these women in their friendship, you needed something that was kind of wildly in contrast, right, with Giselle. And obviously, we'll get to Ellen, but...
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I think definitely I also wanted to write, just like write these women really obsessed with their work, you know, like, and like Giselle was always an artist first. Like, it felt very important for me to write, like, these, I don't know, like art monsters who are just like, I will do anything for my work, whether it's, you know, making a website like Jackie does, or making art like Giselle does, or, you know, doing Ellen's work with activism. Like, they're constantly sort of being placed into boxes by other people who are like doing, like, you know, Asian American art, or you're like, you're feminist or whatever. And they're just like, whatever it takes, you know, and that was sort of always very important for me, just to write people, write these characters who are just very obsessed with their work and those different projects.
It's fun to read, though. It's really fun to read.
So, you know, I guess I kind of relate. Like, I was talking to a friend today. It was like, you know, like, it's so hard to find a hobby that isn't work.
I mean, everything's work, but also when you work with words, it's kind of hard to not be in the thing.
Yeah, like reading. You
know, I mean, yeah, it's rare that I'm not reading for work, but even when I'm reading for pleasure, it's kind of like, oh, right, okay. And then, like, the brain goes off and the hamster's on the wheel and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, I have an idea. And then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And you're like, oh, right. And then there's Ellen. And Ellen is the kid from Queens who is in New Jersey because her parents are at this 4th of July party. And she's like, ugh, where are the kids? Can I hang out with interesting people, please? And she's actually, yes, she's really dedicated to her work, too. She's an activist. But she also sees the world in a slightly different way from Giselle and Jackie. And I love the counterbalance between the three of them. How else do we get the sort of 360 of Lisa Coe's brain, right?
Is that not what a novel is, really?
Yes, exactly. It's the interiority and the passage of time. Like, this is what a novel is designed to do. It's really tightly written, though. I mean, this is, what, 250 pages?
It's really tight. I tried to, like, trim it down a lot.
Did you always know it was going to be these three women?
No. Okay. It started off as Jackie and Giselle. The working title was Jackie and Giselle for several years. But Ellen was there, you know, she was a tertiary character. And then about 2.5 years in, I had what I call like a light bulb moment where I realized that she was like the third protagonist and arguably like kind of the narrator protagonist in a way, and not just sort of like a wacky neighbor friend who was there asserting herself into the story. So yeah, light bulb meaning like I feel like fortunately I solved the problem because I was like, something's not working, I don't know what it is. And then unfortunately I had to fix it, meaning I had to like write a whole new third of the novel and figure out what her storyline was. But it was actually very helpful because it like kind of gave that equal weight to, like, you know, there's like the art world for Giselle, the tech world for Jackie, and just how those things also work together, like with, you know, the political economy of New York and the US and the world. And then the third sort of missing piece at the time was like Ellen's piece around like real estate interests and how those things sort of work like in a machine together, especially in New York.
And you end up covering sort of 60 years in the history of this friendship, right? Like, I got to the end of Giselle's section, then I'm going through Jack. And then I realized that you've given sort of each woman her own turn. Without losing sight of the others, please don't misunderstand me, but I love the structure. Like, it's just a very clean sort of three-act novel, but three acts within each act of the, and the way it all comes together is just like, hi. So can we talk about the structure? Because I'm not sure, I think this needed the slightly experimental structure that you gave it. I can't imagine it any other way.
Yeah, I mean, it took a lot of sort of tweaking, I think. I write really long and then cut, you know. So, like you mentioned, like, they're actually all, like, I was so compulsive about it, but they're all pretty much the same exact word count, all three of the sections.
I did not catch that part.
Yeah, and so, like, I think what I wanted the structure to do was, like, not only move through time and then through, like, each of the characters' arcs and each have each of the sections sort of be representative of a certain time, a certain like industry, but then also have, I mean, I feel like Ellen is sort of like the moral center in a way of the book. And she's sort of, you know, as a young person, she's definitely kind of has that, you know, young activist vibe, just being like, well, you've got to do the thing and this is a way to do it. And like, you know, right or wrong, you know, it's kind of like a little binary. As she gets older, like as one does, like some of these things start to, you know, get more complicated. And yeah, so I feel like the structure is sort of like moving, like it's both like she's kind of being like the theme of memory is so important. And for her, like there's so much that's been forgotten, both because people have been forced to, and both because people have chosen to, because things are equal and you age. And so sort of, even if it's not like literally her remembering the stories of Giselle and Jackie's past and her past, it's kind of like being given that access to the past and those memories sort of provides her with the direction she needs to figure out.
Yeah, but also time sneaks up on Ellen, right? Mm-hmm. Like it sneaks up on all of us, but it's yeah. Actually having this conversation with someone offline the other day where I was like, my sense of time has gotten really, really swirly.
Very strange. Yeah.
Yeah. And watching Giselle and Jackie, but especially Ellen, because, you know, with Ellen, we're really in 2040 and there's a lot that's familiar and, mm-hmm. and you do that thing like good dystopians, right? Like, and it's not that dystopian. It's more like along the lines of say Emily St. John Mandel, right? Yeah. Like there's way more familiar than not.
It's a little soft.
No, but I just watching Ellen sort of figure out what was happening to her when she'd gone from being so sure of everything, mm-hmm. right? Like Giselle was always kind of like, huh, I think I'm going to do this thing. Not like totally head boppy, but she and Jackie were a little less sure of their footing kind of early on, where Ellen was always like, no, she had a plan. She knew what she was doing. She was committed to all of these things. And then watching her get sort of soft was unexpected, but it was nice. And I obviously we're leaving out lots of the passage of all of these things, but it really was a nice touch.
Thank you.
And again, like when you're writing about this kind of friendship though, right? 60 years. Mm-hmm. Three women, similar but not. Everyone's, you know, you don't want people sounding exactly like each other. Are you mapping this out as you go, or you're just letting yourself write and then going back and just whacking it all until you get the thing that you want?
Mostly the latter. I always have aspirations to like be the kind of author who's like, I'm going to outline and I'm going to write another draft and then I'm going to be, you know, but I can't do that. So I felt pretty certain about like the style and tone I wanted for each of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With Giselle, it was sort of this, I don't know, like the aesthetic of a kind of artist biography, right? So, you know, the development of like the artist as a young person. and so I just really wanted these kind of very concise scenes that were just mm-hmm. like, this happened, you know, and sort of leading to that point in her career where she decides to do this. And I feel like it's also evocative of that like suburban childhood, like meandering, figuring things out. And then for Jackie, it felt very much like I wanted it to be more frenetic, mimic the time where it's a tighter time span. It's like 1 year in the life of, you know, this .com, like 1990, 2000, before the crash. You know, everybody's just sort of like really tightly wound and obsessed with money and like IPO and all this stuff. And all the drama is also so mundane, but it feels very life or death, you know, like, are we going to go public? You know, are we going to like, this is going to happen, you know? You know, it's just that really intense, like optimism at the time that seems very absurd now in retrospect.
But also the kind of year you're writing about that Jackie has, it's like, yeah, it's a year on a calendar. It's actually a year in dog years. It really, like, when you look back at sort of the lifespan of some of these things, right, some of these companies and some of these projects and whatnot, and then the things that actually survived, you're like, that's the thing that, oh, wow, that, okay. Of the 9 iterations of whatever goofy time-saving thing it was supposed to be, that's the one that lives, or that's the idea? And you're just like, all right. And I say this as a person who's, you know,
actually content to walk around with a supercomputer in my pocket. Like, I understand, there's a certain amount of ridiculousness that goes from having that kind of convenience, right? But I also like to think, well, I've turned off all the trackers and I've turned off all the microphones and I've turned off all the things. And yet, then things pop up in your phone and you're just like, oh, the robots are welcome to punt themselves into the sun. Like, I...
Oh, yeah. Keep scanning your eyeballs in the subway.
All of it. Please, I fly enough. And somehow retinal scans feel like a step too far, but you can have my fingerprints so I don't have to take my shoes off.
I feel like, okay, so I still have a MetroCard, even though I know it doesn't matter. I'm still using my credit card. Like, I'm traveling. But for some reason, I'm just like, it's just a step too far.
I'm still on a MetroCard, too. Yeah. And I mean, it's faster to whip out your phone. And yet, I'm just like, you know what?
Here I am swiping like 10 times to try to get through.
It's wild, but watching the evolution of our society through the eyes of these three women, too, and the way you do it. I mean, performance art also was a flashpoint. Like, if you think about it, in the 80s, you know, Jesse Helms had lots of feelings about lots of things. And suddenly artists that none of us had really been exposed to, we all knew their names.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea that you've got to defend your art when, in fact, it's not like, you know, Karen Finley was on the side of a bus driving down Fifth Avenue, right? Like, there's so many flashpoints in the last like 40 years, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But again, I keep coming back to watching Giselle learn how to make her art, right? And like, what does it for her, and like the sort of physical challenges she puts herself through, but also like there are some mental challenges, but watching her figure out like what has meaning for her is kind of cool.
Right, right.
It's a wild coming of age. And yeah, you do mimic an artist's biography, but at the same time, like, I don't really feel like I've met a character like Giselle recently in literature. I just feel like she's kind of a standout.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start with her? Like, was she, I know you said Jackie and Giselle were sort of the start and then you had to fix the Ellen situation, but I kind of feel like Giselle is more of you than anyone.
We're not talking
yeah. autofiction. I'm just talking like in the spiritual inheritance kind of thing of the character from the writer kind of thing. But I feel like you're closer to her than anyone else.
You know, it's interesting. I started with Jackie and Giselle, and I definitely always from the very, very early drafts had two friends who were childhood friends, collaborators, and there was just tension in their friendship. And it was somebody looking back from the vantage point of middle age. So that was always sort of baked in, along with like all these tech anxieties. So clearly this is like, it's never far from my mind. The internet always disappeared, like something happened. So I feel like the I character was actually Jackie, and Jackie was looking back at Giselle's fame, like in this early iteration, which resembles nothing about the current book. Yeah, like the character kind of came to fame, and then the Jackie character felt a little resentful and was like, I also contributed to that, and sort of this push-pull in their friendship about mm-hmm. one being like the smart techie one and one being the kind of like artsy weirdo, and just how they're seen by like different friends and by like the world at large.
When The Leavers came out, I think I wasn't the only person who picked up an early galley and said, huh, this is really interesting. Like, you're doing a lot in that novel, and it sells like crazy still, which delights me to no end. You wanted to make a point, but make the point in the context of the story. And you've got mom and you've got her son, and eventually he gets adopted. So you're talking about, you know, immigration and home and belonging and identity and all of these things. And I was very close to both Polly and Daniel. And Daniel's parents, his adoptive parents, are very well-intentioned. Everyone is very well-intentioned. It's just systems are broken, right? But what did you learn writing that book that you needed? Because they're different in tone. They're different in structure. I mean, you know, debut versus sophomore. Sometimes it's harder to publish a sophomore book. But also, you were a finalist for the National Book Award, like critically acclaimed. We weren't the only, obviously the Discover Award wasn't the only prize you'd gotten, but a lot happened very quickly for a debut, and that doesn't always happen. And now you're following it up and it's like, oh, hi. Hello, world.
Can we talk about what that feels like and sure. how you got, what you learned from that first book that you're going to bring to the second?
Look, I mean, it's true. It's a very different time, and it feels like a million years have passed. Yeah. You know, and definitely the act of kind of disappearing to write a novel, and the years that have happened have been very strange, obviously. So you know, for everybody. So it definitely feels like being like, I'm still alive. Here I am, emerging from my cave. You know, I think when I look back on it, I started writing The Leavers in 2008 or 2009, which is, you know, shockingly about the same amount of time between now. That's the same amount of time between now and Ellen's section. 2041 feels very far away, but 2008, like, you know, it is far away. It's not that. In some ways, like that first book was written like against something. Like there was definitely some part, and the first book is definitely like almost like the accumulation of your whole life, because you're like carrying all that material with you for four decades, right? And I was really kind of writing against this dominant narrative of like immigration and assimilation, and like against the sort of mainstream history around those things. And I felt a little like, maybe having done it, I felt that I no longer had to do it for this book. Like it was kind of out of my system. And instead the challenge was trying to write like towards something. So I feel like a lot of the book was kind of me challenging myself to write something, I don't know, that felt both, especially in the future section, that felt both, that made room for both like the possibility of reality and also like a sort of, I don't know, like visionary hope feels kind of corny, but like, you know, a sort of survival, collective survival regardless. So there was like more, it was less about writing against something and more like writing towards like a form of love, I guess.
I mean, it's hard to be hopeful, right? Like there's that line, that Emily Dickinson line, that hope is a muscle. Like, it kind of is. So, I mean, actually, more than it kind of is, hope is a muscle. And not because I read Emily Dickinson Young. I mean, hope is a muscle. No, I like this idea, though, of challenging yourself. And I like the idea, too, of saying, hey, I wrote what I wrote in the first book, and I don't necessarily need to keep going back to that particular piece. I felt very connected to all three of these women, even though I didn't, you know, I don't necessarily share the same whatever with them, but I felt really plugged into them in a way that was just fun, despite everything that was happening. You know, some good stuff happened, some weird stuff happened, some stuff where you're like, ooh,
yep.
I'm sorry you went through that door. But influences, can we talk about influences too? I mean, you're pulling from art, I know music is a huge thing for you personally. You know, literature, music, art, all of the things you pull from. Let's talk about those influences for a second.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of art. You know, Taixing Shea, I mentioned, like, on Kawara is another artist. For 50 years, he would paint the date every day on a painting, and it had to be in a certain font, depending on where he was in the world and the language. Anyway, I'm just obsessed with them. Like, I've always felt them very moving, and, you know, I think also I've also like been a very diligent journal keeper, for better or for worse. So that's something I think that Giselle's art kind of speaks to, like art as a way to like measure the days and to sort of like use time, you know, and definitely like the performance art of Adrienne Piper. Like she does these videos where she's like dressed up and sort of in public, you know, another kind of performance artist that Giselle's informed by, his work. So a lot of those, you know, book-wise, yeah, you know, I remember reading like different forms of just like artist biographies just out of curiosity, like what are different people do it? Like there's a biography of Joni Mitchell. Like I'm not even really a fan, but I was just like, how do you write about artists? Like how do people do it? The Chris Krauss After Kathy Acker book was definitely something that I, you know, was like, this is also really interesting, like in terms of an unconventional way to tell the story of artists through the eyes of many people. Yeah, I feel like I was also drawn to like books that I was curious about, like books that function in thirds. So like Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. What else came out? Oh, Asymmetry by Lisa Holliday was another one that came out a few years ago around that time. Like just different ways of structuring a book with different kind of points of view and kind of unexpected turns.
You've been writing basically since you were a kid, if I remember correctly, right? Not just journal keeping, but like you've known since you were like five that this was going to be your thing. Mm-hmm. So I want to go back though to some of the writers that, you know, helped get us here to where you're thinking, oh, I should look at this after Kathy Acker. But like, I mean, yeah, we're talking specifically about Memory Piece, but there's a lot that goes into deciding to be a novelist. And, you know, I know you've said this in other interviews, you know, you weren't reading The New Yorker at home. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your parents wanted you to have a plan that didn't really involve being a freelance writer. Right. But yeah, so who are some of the really big, like long-standing kind of influences?
I feel like the stories of Alice Munro really blew my mind when I read her in like maybe early in college. Like I really, and I still don't know how she does it, you know, and, right. and they have a sort of like bleakness and they're all about the passage of time, you know, mm-hmm. something like those themes really resonated with me, even if mm-hmm. the landscape and the setting was so foreign. That was definitely a very early influence. A book that I returned to recently was Jessica Hagedorn's Gangster of Love.
Oh, wow. I had not read that in a really yeah, I know. Long like, time.
I have it on my bookshelf and I just saw it at some point like during the first year of the pandemic and I was like, wow, you know, and I took it down. I had marked it up in the beginning that said I read it in like 1996. And it was such a great book to return to. It's about like a young woman artist moving to New York, you know, from California and just having this like wild time. And, you know, I was able to see, like, I completely forgot about it mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. never thought about it while writing the memory piece. And when I reread it, I was like, this book really influenced my life. Mm-hmm. I forgot about, you know, I just unconsciously, it must have really influenced like moving to New York and making art, like just seeing that example, I think. Right. And like the character is Filipino, you know, and just like how like it must have had such an impact.
I love that. I have not thought about that book in a minute. Yeah. I'm just like, do I have time to squeeze? Like, what did the next couple of weeks look like? Can I get away with squeeze? Because it's not crazy long either. Like, I remember it being really kind of tightly written.
Yeah. It's a lot of like vignettes, kind of.
Yeah. And I'm just also trying to remember where on the shelf it might be. That's also, sometimes that's kind of the, have I possibly repurchased books that I probably aren't?
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes it's just faster. I'm not sure where that is. Did writing Memory Piece change you, though? Because I feel like there's so much more of you in this book than there is of you, say, in The Leavers. Like, The Leavers, it's a really different feel in terms of narrative voice. It's a really different kind of read. Still beautifully written, but it's a different kind of read. And I feel like it's not just of the moment, right? Like you're not speaking just to the social condition that's happening in, you know, 2017 as the book is coming out kind of thing. But that it's a very specific, pointed kind of reading experience. And this is somehow a little dreamier, a little looser, probably because you did all those cuts. But can we just talk about holding the two sort of in conversation with each other and structure more than anything? Because it's kind of wild to me that these are the two books that I'm talking to you about, and they're both yours.
I mean, I think I really consciously wanted to write a different book just, you know, because why? I don't know. It's like when you spend so long doing something, it's like you feel like you've purged it from you. Like you might need to like grapple with whatever it was I was asking and figuring out. Like yeah. I've done it. Like I spent 8 years of my life doing it and I've talked about it for another 2 years. Like I think I can put it to rest for a while. Yeah. You know? And also the world has changed and what we're responding to has changed. So yeah, both that and both like my own sort of overachiever kind of, you know, energy that's like, but I need to challenge myself. It has to be like, you know, it's like, I gotta work harder. Can't just do the same thing, you know? So, yeah. So it was very, very much a deliberate decision. But I feel like they do have, you know, there is sort of like thematically things in common that they have, you know, which I think they both are sort of, I don't know, questioning some sort of like myth about America.
Oh yeah.
They're all absolutely. You know, that's maybe like that's my work, right? That's like what I'm interested in. It's sort of just like taking that apart, you know, and you know, like, how did we get here? And like, what's really going on? And yeah, just from like a different standpoint.
I mean, I'm all for a novel that's going to entertain me, right? Like, I'm there are plenty of times where I just want to read a thing and be entertained. You know, read a book, watch a movie. I'm going to choose the book, right? That's just who I am. But I do really enjoy a narrative that is going to just poke me a little bit and make me question sort of not necessarily everything at once, but I do love the idea that you're sort of saying the American dream.
Yeah, right.
You know, doesn't necessarily work the way everyone thinks it does.
Right.
But there are a lot of ways to come to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's so many different ways to come to it. And it's not like you're writing a history book. It's not like you're writing some sort of polemic. It's just kind of like, well, here are people doing the best they can with what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And right. That's how we got here. I mean, that I like to engage with art on that level. Do you think writing Memory Piece changed you, though, beyond the I like to challenge myself type A? Like, do you feel like it changed you as an artist or freed you up to do something different next kind of thing?
I feel like it freed me up to do something different next because whatever I did with that, I know how to do again. it definitely satisfied my curiosity in terms of writing that kind of book, you know, whatever kind of book is. You know, I also feel like it changed me like as a person, like as anything you work on for a long period of time does. And in some ways, like so much of it, especially I feel like the Ellen section was written in some ways, like in response to what I was trying to figure out, like, you know, like how do we keep going when things are bad? And, you know, even part of it was just me imagining, like, you know, I've been living here for 25 years and I was having all this anxiety as friends were leaving, you know, the city, just being like, what if I'm the last one here? And so I just literally decided to make her like the last one, like, you know, in a way, and imagine my way into that. And, you know, inadvertently it helped me prioritize like my own friendships and community because so much of the book centers around that importance.
Was figuring out Ellen the biggest surprise in the book for you, or was it a series of surprises? I mean, I know you don't outline, you said that at the top of the show, but I still think there's a discovery piece and a looseness to reading Memory Piece that makes me think that maybe you were kind of pleasantly surprised in ways that readers were too.
Interesting. I feel like, I mean, Ellen's presence and like role felt like a large surprise. Also, the way that the three sections moved together and then the structure as a whole felt like maybe, I don't know if surprises were, but maybe the like most important thing for me to like tie to, you know, right? Like that was the question. Like, now I know I have these characters. I know they live these lives, but also like, how is it working as novel? And so maybe that was sort of the answer, you know?
All right. You know what? We are getting dangerously close to revealing some spoilers. So what I'm going to say, Lisa, is this. I love Memory Piece. I love these women. I love what you've done. I love how tightly written this book is. I flew through it. But I am going to say, hey, readers, just go pick up Memory Piece because it's really cool. And I do not want to spoil this book for you. I do not want to be responsible for that. So Lisa Coe, thank you so very much for joining us on Poured Over. This was a real treat.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me, Mula.
Hello, readers. It's time for another TBR Top Off. We're going to recommend a couple of fantastic books to pick up when you stop in for your copy of Memory Piece. I'm Mark at my Barnes & Noble in Cincinnati, and I'm joined by my book buddy, Jamie. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Mark. I'm Jamie, and I am at my Barnes & Noble in Leawood, Kansas. How are you?
I'm wonderful, as always. I'm surrounded by books. I can't complain. I'm going to go ahead and kick things off. I was thinking about the way that art and humanity can intertwine, and I thought of a newer novel that had come out recently called Set for Life by Andrew Yule. This is a very entertaining and very glib novel about how art and life can connect to each other and how sometimes the two should just stay in their own damn lanes. We get to hang out with our narrator, who is a writer, but his writing career is floundering mostly because of him. He procrastinates terribly And he is in the middle of this bout of mild hedonism that is really distracting him from his goals. But instead of buckling down and turning his focus on his art, he decides instead to squander his talent and have an affair, you know, as one does. So he basically just throws it all away, his career as a college professor, his fantastic relationship with his very, very cool wife, just really decides to throw a grenade into the mix. So not only does this explode all over the place, it maybe is going to give him the material that he wants and needs to write that novel he's been longing to write. Oh, this guy. This is a cringy yet funny novel about academic ennui, about male privilege, about just the literary world. And it just is a very fun satire that makes you want to fully reach into the novel and just grab this guy by the throat. But sometimes you need that in a novel. You need to feel that sort of rage, that sort of eye roll. And you definitely won't forget his voice or the spears thrown at academia at large. This is fun. It is funny. It is obnoxious in the best kind of way. So check out Set for Life by Andrew Yule. Jamie, what do you have for us?
I'm going to say, sometimes I enjoy a anti-hero, a good anti-hero. If you can root for them, then, you know, even when you know they're not doing smart things,
yeah.
Making good choices, I'm always kind of impressed. So mm-hmm. I'm going to talk today, though, about a book that is not about any one person. I'm going to talk about Ling Ma's book of short stories called Bliss Montage, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, just a highly acclaimed book. You may have read her excellent first novel, Severance, and I could just as easily recommend that one here. I love her blending of the supremely weird and the utterly mundane, and I think Lisa Coe's Meditations on Memory fit right into her musings on really every part of our day-to-day existence as humans, plus some other weird stuff. This is a collection of 8 excellent little stories. I do love my story collections that range from fairly straightforward tales to a little magical realism and several wonderful absurd ideas. And while the stories are not all connected, they are about some kind of common themes, the choices we make, which set us on a path. And as she puts it, they freeze us in their consequences. And these characters are struggling to figure out where they fit in our world. So I think whether you typically like a think piece or you suspect the story Yeti Lovemaking was written for you, no judgment. I won't judge you. I think you'll find that these pieces are full of really smart, observant, and precision prose. I love savoring a sentence. And when the author finds the perfect turn of phrase, I get just chills, right? So one of the best stories in the collection, I think, is about a woman who lives in a house with her husband, her 2 children, and her 100 exes, her 100 ex-boyfriends. So her past is literally taking up space in her home. There are no escaping her memories here because the exes themselves can't leave until they decide to go, right? Until they're ready to move on from her. So they're with her, you know, at all times. And another story returning, which is very philosophical kind of story, a wife goes to her husband's homeland. He's from a made-up country, a place called Garboza. And he wants to be buried alive in a ritual that will allow them to begin rekindling and starting their dwindling relationship again. He just has to survive the process first, the burying alive process, in order for them to start over. So she's got ideas in these books. I love it. And G, women experiment with a drug that makes them invisible and that handily frees them from the male gaze. So we get to explore some fun things there. And then, of course, the aforementioned Yeti Lovemaking. I'm not going to spoil for you, but I think the title kind of already spoils it for you. These stories run the gamut. And if you are ready to roll with the strangeness, I think you will be rewarded with really lovely and insightful prose. So again, that one was Bliss Montage, Stories by Ling Ma.
Fantastic. I loved that book. It was so beautifully, deliciously weird. I loved it. Nice pick. But that's all we have for today. I could do this all day, Jamie, but we ran out of time. So thank you so much for tuning in to Poured Over. Please make sure to give us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on our socials at Barnes & Noble. I'm Mark. You can follow my home store at BN Westchester. Jamie, where can we find you?
I am at my home store, which is at BN Leewood KS.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Happy reading. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.